Welcome to EAN Cast, your weekly source for education, research, and updates from the European Academy of Neurology.
Hello and welcome to the EAN Cast Weekly Neurology. My name is Yıldız Değirmenci and I'm an associate editor of the e-learning platform of the European Academy of Neurology EAN Campus. So today I have two distinguished guests with me, Dr. Marie Trutenberg and Dr. Julie Hall. They are both working in the Institute of Psychology at Leiden University, the Netherlands, and they are both well-known experts on neurocognition and movement in healthy population and in neurodegenerative diseases as well, more focusing on the complex relationships of cognition, emotions, and motor functioning in Parkinson's disease, which is also very close to my heart. So welcome, Dr. Maurice. Welcome, Dr. Julie. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Lovely. As I told you, it's a very hot topic for me and very close to my heart. Thank you for accepting our invitation again. So let's start with a general overview. Regarding to your expertise, I would like to start with non-motor profile of Parkinson's disease. So Marit, maybe regarding your cognitive research and interests, so you can give us some clues about the frequency and how often do we see cognitive problems in patients with Parkinson's disease. I would love to hear the mood and behavioral problems from you, Julie, as well. Thank you.
Sure. Yeah, I think when most people think of Parkinson's disease, they mainly consider those physical symptoms. They're also often the most clearly visible symptoms, but indeed nearly all people with Parkinson's will also experience what we call non-motor problems. And these concern a very broad set of problems, and they can include bladder issues, problem with the senses, like reduced smell, visual hallucinations, but also pain and fatigue, and indeed also cognitive changes, which are not visible from the outside. And people in general, but also people with Parkinson's may not always be aware that it can actually be part of the disease itself. But what we see is that people with Parkinson's can develop problems in the domains of memory, attention, executive functions, or more the higher order planning functions, as well as visuospatial skills. And in terms of the frequency, about 25% of people with Parkinson's have moderate difficulties in these domains, which indicates mild cognitive impairment. And approximately half of people with Parkinson's can develop dementia after about 10 years after being diagnosed with the disease. But that also means that half of the people with Parkinson's do not. So I just want to emphasize that as well.
Thank you, Maurice. You just started it with a very good clue about that, because the non-motor profile, including your cognitive changes and all the items that you mentioned, are kind of an unseen part of the iceberg, right? Rather than motor problems, but they can give as much burden as the motor problems, actually, right?
For sure. Yeah. A lot of people with Parkinson's themselves actually indicate that the non-motor symptoms are particularly challenging for them in daily life. And we also know from research that there is a negative impact of these symptoms on their experience quality of life. So they're very important.
Thank you, indeed. And Julie, I really am so keen on listening the behavioral and mood changes in Parkinson's disease as a non-motor profile from your perspective or expertise. How common do we see it? What's the frequency?
Both anxiety and depression are very common in Parkinson's disease. The studies range in have a different range. So some of them report about 5%, but it can go up to about 80%. But in the literature seems to be around a third of the patients that experience anxiety. But my guess would actually be that is still on the lower side, because many of the anxiety symptoms can overlap with the disease. So we see that people with trembling or tremor, for example, or sweating, that can be both be attributed to Parkinson's itself, to the medication effect, but also to anxiety. And also we see that patients sometimes find it hard to articulate their emotion or sometimes avoid situations in which they feel anxious, which is not a great coping strategy. We also see that not all neurologists might still touch upon these behavioral or mood changes. So we actually think that this number might be still a bit higher than one third. And then we also see that a lot of patients have this sub-threshold clinical symptoms. So they experience a heightened profile, but may not be classified as anxious as a disorder.
I'm not sure if you agree, but what do you think? It's not as easy as we talk to recognize these problems, right? In terms of these depression and anxiety, whether it's from the Parkinson's profile or a comorbid disease, we have to think about it to ask for it regularly, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yes. And also not all the patients recognize that it's anxiety themselves, because sometimes they say it comes as a wave, as a together with my motor symptoms, or my trembling gets worse in stress in busy situations. So I think there needs to be more awareness of that these symptoms are actually also related to Parkinson's disease.
Great indeed. So I was wondering, are there any particular forms of this depression or anxiety as a clinical picture, if we think about in patients with Parkinson's disease? Is there a specific type that differs from the general population, the anxiety and depression that we see in general population?
Yeah, we see that these classical types in the general population for anxiety, like panic attacks or social anxiety or generalized anxiety, also happen in people with Parkinson's disease. But many people are also classified as not otherwise specified. Which means that their symptoms don't perfectly map onto the usual like DSM categories.
Yeah, indeed.
But, yeah, so there might also be something very unique to anxiety in Parkinson's disease.
I would like to keep these two conditions together to discuss with, because it's not easy to separate, right? Cognition and anxiety, let's think about it together. Marit, can you please describe the cognitive problems seen in Parkinson's disease patients? Is there a specific clinical picture that we see? For example, just to give a clue, is there any differences in the cognitive profile decline that we see in Alzheimer's disease patients? When we look in the Parkinson's disease patients?
Yeah, in people with Alzheimer's disease, there is a really strong focus on the memory aspect. In Parkinson's disease, we see that memory can also be affected, but it's a bit broader than that. The executive functioning is also often compromised. So executive functioning refers to higher order cognitive processes like planning. So if you are cooking and you want to make sure that all your elements of your dish are done at the same time, can you still oversee that? Things like attention and visuospatial functioning are also often affected, which is not something that would be specific for Alzheimer's. So that's where you can really see differences between the two profiles.
Great indeed. So a little bit more deepening into your main research areas, but starting with you, Marit, what do you think? Would you like to talk about the early predictors of cognitive decline in patients with Parkinson's disease? I mean, are there any cognitive tests to detect the cognitive decline earlier in patients with Parkinson's disease for the early diagnosis and recognition?
Yeah, that is a really fantastic and important question. We were just before talking about the frequency of cognitive problems, and we see that roughly half of the people develop dementia over 10 years, but the other half doesn't. And it's still very difficult to predict which patients will and which patients will not develop such problems. But for adequate treatment and indeed early intervention, this is actually very important to signal as early as possible. There is no specific cognitive test that can do this at this point in time, but we have looked into something that we call practice effects on cognitive tests to see if we can use those as early predictors. And we were actually inspired by the Alzheimer's research field, where they already have looked into such effects and the possibility of predicting cognition in the future by this approach, and wanted to see if this also applies to Parkinson's. So maybe to explain what practice effects are for people unfamiliar with them, they relate to improvements on neuropsychological tests if you perform them repeatedly. Because oftentimes if you see a test, like you need to remember a certain list of words or copy a certain drawing, if you do that multiple times, your performance gets better. It's a learning effect. And as a neuropsychologist, we often initially tend to treat this as noise, right? Something that makes it difficult to measure what we exactly want to measure. But Alzheimer's disease has shown us that there's actually very valuable information in this.
Well, this is really very important thing to address. I echo you in this term, Marit, and I really want to address the same question to you in terms of depression and anxiety, Julie. Are there any specific tools or screening tests for the earlier detection of anxiety or depression and Parkinson's disease?
For the early detection, I'm not too sure of, actually. In research, how anxiety is often diagnosed or measured using different questionnaires. And until recently, they were quite generic. There's been some attempts to make it a bit more specific. So there's the Parkinson Anxiety Scale, for example, that looks at different subtypes of anxiety, such as persistent anxiety or episodic and avoidance behavior, that can delineate or they can be more specific to the disease. Very recently, there's also a new questionnaire has been developed that looked at triggers for anxiety. So they are not specifically aimed for earlier detection, but they are efforts to be more specific for Parkinson's disease.
Thank you. This is very important to detect as early as we can in terms of, these behavioral changes or cognitive changes to cope with the non-motor profile as well, the Parkinson's disease. So
to add to that, anxiety and depression are also symptoms that occur very early in the disease. So oftentimes way earlier than the motor symptoms appear. So having a good detection system for those mood changes is very important for Parkinson's.
Thank you so much. I was thinking about the effects of these conditions, both of them, the cognitive decline as well as the mood changes in depression and anxiety, the impact of these two conditions on the motor profile of the patients with Parkinson's disease. Do you think they have an impact overall, do you think that they have an impact on the motor profile, motor functioning of the patients with Parkinson's disease?
Yes, absolutely. Anxiety exacerbates motor symptoms like freezing of gait, but also tremor. Anxiety might also manifest as fear of falling. So people might avoid certain situations. And it has, not just on motor symptoms, also on non-motor symptoms, but it can have therefore a really big impact on someone's independence and quality of life.
So they affect the daily living activities as well, right? As a result of it.
Yeah.
And what do you think? Yeah. What do you think about the cognition, Marit?
Yeah. In one of the other episodes, we've already touched upon the link between cognition and movement, and how there's also cognitive processes involved in motor behavior. So I'm not aware of studies that have specifically looked into the relation between cognitive functioning in the sense of intact or not intact, but we have definitely seen in my work and that of others that there are strong links between cognition and movement also in people with Parkinson's that can actually be, these two processes can be differentially affected by medication. And if we talk about, for example, problems with impulse control that can also happen in people with Parkinson's, we also see both a motor component and a cognitive component at the behavioral but also at the neural level.
So as we talk, we emphasize and we recognize that they are a burden for the motor profile, the daily living activities, and even for the other non-motor symptoms for patients with Parkinson's disease. Now, I was thinking of stigmatizing and disabling mode of this Parkinson's disease, counting the anxiety and depression in with the cognitive decline. We have to treat the patients, right? We have to give them some care, some help to overcome with these problems. So what do you think, what are the algorithmic approaches to treat these problems? How shall we approach the cognitive decline? This is a question for you, Marit, obviously. And for the mood disorders and the psychiatric aspects, Julie, how can we cope with them?
Yeah, I can start about the cognitive part. Neuropsychologists and psychologists can play a really big role in this. mostly there's strategies, like tips and tricks that we can share with people who are experiencing cognitive problems. And sometimes these are seemingly really simple, right? If you're forgetting your groceries, when you are like what groceries you wanted to buy when you go to the grocery store, maybe make a list while you're at home and then bring it to the grocery store while you're shopping. And while this may seem like very, very simple tricks, they can actually make a big change in people's lives. So there's a lot of very practical tips that psychologists can share with people with Parkinson's who experience cognitive problems.
And then is there a specific treatment guideline for the cognitive problems in terms of pills, pharmacological agents?
That is not something that I am aware of. I don't have an answer to that.
We can delete this part. Now, Julie, I really am wondering about your perspective in terms of approaching to patients to overcome these problems. Or are there any guidelines?
Yes. Well, first, I think we need to create more awareness that anxiety is common.
Sure.
And also that it can look different than a typical anxiety in the general population. And I know that some clinicians do ask the question, like, how's your mood, but might not more explore anxiety and depression in detail. So how it differently manifests in different patients is really important. Some patients, for example, have this wearing off anxiety, which is very much related to their medication. So then medication adjustments may help. But some patients have this more generalized anxiety or persistent anxiety. And there has been some studies that showed here that cognitive behavioral therapy might be helpful. Whereas in situational anxiety or panic attacks, then exposure therapy might be useful. Of course, there's also pharmacological treatments such as SSRIs, similar to the medication in the general population. But many patients do not want additional medication, pharmacological medication. So we also need to look at different treatment approaches like exercise or acceptance behavioral therapy.
Very nice indeed. And cognitive behavioral therapy, what do you think about the impact of this therapy on patients with Parkinson's disease?
I think it can be a really useful technique, especially in this population that has already many medications. But it might not be helpful for everyone, and not all patients want to talk about their mood or problems. But also some patients are cognitively impaired, and then it's much more difficult to apply such a therapy.
So we can summarize that the treatment options, the approaches should also be tailored according to the needs of the patients.
Absolutely,
right?
Yes.
Suffering from these problems. These non-motor problems, which are very important. Well, thank you both so much. It was so delightful to hear this very interesting topic. And it was, as I told you before, it's very close to my heart. And I learned a lot from you. Thank you for sharing your knowledge and expertise. Last but not least, do you have anything to share with our audience as a take-home message?
Together with Marit, we are also looking into how anxiety differently manifests in patients. We're looking not just at the anxiety questionnaires, but also at other measures like tolerance for uncertainty or sense of control or fear of falling to get a better picture. And then we combine this with behavioral tasks such as virtual reality, in which we've created different situations that can evoke different stressful events. So we are trying to get a better picture of how anxiety manifests in patients with Parkinson's disease.
Yeah, with the hope of also then opening the avenues, new avenues for treatment, right? If we see that there's different types of profiles, then maybe those profiles also require individualized treatment strategies.
That's really brilliant. And this is really so interesting. We definitely should arrange another podcast just focusing on your research. That's brilliant indeed. We definitely ask for another podcast regarding your research areas. Thank you both so much. It was a pleasure to be with you today. And thanks to our audience. I hope they enjoyed as much as I enjoyed listening to you. So goodbye.
This has been EANcast Weekly Neurology. Thank you for listening. Be sure to follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your preferred podcatcher for weekly updates from the European Academy of Neurology. You can also listen to this and all of our previous episodes on the EAN campus to gain points and become an EAN expert in any of our 29 neurological specialties. Simply become an EAN individual member to gain access. For more information, visit ean.org/membership. That's ean.org/membership. Thanks for listening. EANcast Weekly Neurology is your unbiased and independent source for educational and research-related neurological content. Although all content is provided by experts in their field, it should not be considered official medical advice.